I think for some reason, God has given me an ability to see things that other people can't see. And what drives me is to explore those things and share them with the world. You're running from something, running to something. You have to be careful sometimes that you're not running from the wrong thing and running to the wrong thing. You're not going to run from homelessness. You're not going to run from all these different things. You run from the lesser version of you.
You talked about depression being a luxury of the rich or of the wealthy, but I think everyone can get depressed.
A part of what develops resilience in a person's life is choosing to move to your highest self, even when you have the safety net that protects you in your lowest self.
You're listening to Mind Shift. My name is Aaron McManus, and I'm here with my dad, Erwin McManus. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing good, man. It's so good to be back.
It is good to be back. We took a few weeks off. We were traveling. We were getting a few other things done, doing the arena. Now we're back on the podcast. It's good to be here, back in LA.
Not to mention I had a month of just severe migraines, so it was really limiting how much time I could focus on things like this. But it's good to be back. Good to have my head back. Good to be back in full steam ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were taking a few. I wasn't going to air it out, but since you talked about it, yeah, you had some health stuff we were focusing on, and you know, we tried to film the pod, but you were getting some pretty severe migraines and headaches and sinus attacks, and you know, but you look great. How do you feel? You feeling better?
I feel good. I'm ready to roll, man. I haven't had a headache today, and this is like the first day so far where I have no pain. So I'm pretty happy.
Amazing.
So just don't be a cause of a headache today as we do this Mind Shift podcast.
No, I feel like now it's me. I woke up, you know, we flew back on Saturday night, or you flew to Mexico City and I flew back to LA, and I woke up really stuffy. So we're here we are. If you're wondering if this is my real voice, no. Yeah, you know.
As long as one of us is feeling good, we're okay.
Yeah. We're going to make this. We're going to make it. Guys, if you're listening right now, we want to just invite you to, one, hit subscribe on YouTube, and to rate and review this podcast on Spotify and Apple Music. We want to thank you guys so much for listening to these podcasts. We really appreciate you guys. And if you're wondering how to go deeper with us, join the arena. TheArenaSummit.com. We'll link it in the episode information and check it out. Okay, Dad. So we were in Mexico with some good friends, some new friends, but good friends.
Yeah.
And it's always fun to hang out with another father and son. And it brought up such good conversations. And, you know, me and you were always talking about random things. And this podcast is kind of a delineation or an extension of those, you know, long conversations that we have. We were talking about this idea of how to grow up in nepotism. But really it was, how do you look at life and look at different scenarios, whether it's with the workforce or education, and how do you really have that drive, whether you grew up with some type of privilege or advantage, or with nothing at all? And you know, and me and this young guy, we were in Mexico together, and we were, obviously I was with you and our other good friend, and it was his dad, and you guys kind of came from nothing, both with single moms who raised you guys, and you guys picked up this incredible ability to an incredible drive. You have this tenacity with life, right? And our friend is I guess he's retired, but really he exited his company and he's kind of enjoying life and volunteers and does some other things to kind of give back to the community. And you obviously are 65 and grinding and still chasing after life. But both of you guys are very hardworking people and very successful people. And so I was talking with the son about, you know, how does that feel? How is that growing up? Everyone asks me that, but I was able to ask him, kind of flip it around on him, and how is that experience for him? And we were, what?
I thought it was interesting. He'd never really heard the word nepotism before.
No.
So he didn't know the concept.
And maybe that's a Hollywood thing, because,
you know, I also think, if I could just say this.
Say it.
It's like a ministry thing. Like
is
a
it?
Christian thing, where Christians seem to sometimes be more upset about nepotism than
anyone else.
Than people in just the regular world.
I don't know, because I mean, I take it from a perspective of like the TMZ thing, Nepo babies that's on like social media, you know, like the Kai Gerbers and the Hadids and the Kardashians and all of these people who kind of inherit wealth, fortune, and fame from these people who came before them. And so me and him were having this like lighthearted but kind of deep conversation about how do you feel? You know, it's obviously, it's a little bit harder to pick up It's not. It is the thing is that I feel like I've had a massive advantage in life by being your son. But a huge advantage or a huge component to that advantage was the fact that I stayed close to you, right? I didn't just take the advantage and run off. I really did stay close to you, and we've had, you know, a really amazing relationship, you know, ups and downs at time. But I, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I used a cliche that said it's not a shadow. I don't live in a shadow. I live in the shade of the success of his life. Here's the conversation that I want to present. Okay. So we had this chat, and it was a really good chat. And this young guy is amazing. He's an amazing guy. And I kind of resonate with him because I think coming out of college, I was really lost. I didn't know quite what I was going to do. If you hadn't started a company while I was in college outside of church, I would have really been lost. You know, I think 23, 24, I was working at YSL in New York. So that was a unique experience as well. But for the most part, you know, so much of my working life, my career life has been attached to you to some degree. So with that comes, you know, rumors and people who, you know, would love to just charge at me, hey, you're a Nepo baby, there's nepotism, you have this advantage, you have all of these things. Yes, what am I supposed to do with it? So a lot of our conversations were about how to take the advantage that you're given and to run with it.
Yeah, I think one thing that strikes me is I think the whole idea of nepotism comes from two dominant places. One is the break in family tradition, and to the envy of people who feel that they have, quote, privilege. And the break in family tradition is this. If your dad was a blacksmith, he was going to mentor you to become a blacksmith. And if things went well for that family, you would take over the blacksmith company. You know, if your dad was a farmer, he would mentor you, raise you to be a farmer, and then one day you would take over the farm. And so part of the reason people had children was to be able to, in a sense, pass on their work and their legacy, and then also, frankly, to have their children take care of them when they're older.
Right.
And so I think a part of the concept of nepotism comes because we're so disconnected that we no longer see ourselves as an extension of a family. And so we don't think about becoming what our fathers were, what our mothers were. And ironically, everyone who has a family member who was something has a psychological advantage, because once you have a doctor in your family, you know being a doctor is possible. Once you have a lawyer in your family, you know being a lawyer is possible. Once you have an entrepreneur in your family, you know being an entrepreneur is possible. So it shouldn't surprise us that trades, in a sense, are passed on from generation to generation. But there's also, I think, this cultural envy where you feel like it's just not fair that someone else didn't start the same starting line. And that's where the whole, you know, cultural thing of nepotism, where, you know, if you're Bill Gates's kid, you just clearly have a distinct advantage, or you know, one of Elon Musk's children, you're probably going to have a distinct advantage. And that's just real life, you know. But I think there's also a huge disadvantage. You know, a lot of, you think, oh, being Michael Jackson's kid would be an advantage, but, you know, you can see there were clear disadvantages. You could see that being the child of someone who, quote, had celebrity or fame or power or wealth, it can be pretty devastating too. And, you know, and so, yeah, you grew up with some advantages being my son, but you grew up with so many disadvantages that other people didn't have to deal with.
Okay, like what?
Oh, the expectation of others from the age of 6 to be perfect.
Yeah, it was really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you didn't get to grow up in a shadow. Like, you didn't grow up in the protection of anonymity. There was a light on you from childhood, and if you were not the perfect child, there were 50 people who wanted to come point that out to us. You know, and you couldn't just be a junior high kid or a high school kid. You couldn't date without making any mistakes. You had to have a perfect life, or everyone would highlight it and come tell Kim or me.
Yeah. And I mean, to this day, people go to my mother.
Yeah.
And we'll bring up things and say, you know, Aaron did this or what. And I'm like, Mom, I'm 35. tell them to shut their mouth. And also, like, who cares? I'm an adult. I'm allowed to just live my life. And it was always just like a funny, there is a funny thing. And I wonder how much of that is put upon us, and how much of that do we bring upon ourselves?
Yeah. I think that's a good question. And I think it's different for different people, you know. And if you don't have a lot of sensitivity to the opinions of others or to the acceptance of others, it's going to have less effect. But if you are sensitive and caring and what people think about you and say about you matters, you're going to be more affected by that. And you were always a very sensitive, caring, tender kid. And so all that negative input had a significant impact on you. I'm just saying that there are positives to being, quote, a Nepo baby, but there are also a lot of negatives, which is why you see a lot of fragmented, broken human beings when they grow up with so much privilege and so much opportunity. But one of the things we were talking about with Tom and his son was that when you're not a Nepo baby, I guess, you know.
Right. I don't think me and Tom's son are, but we were talking about like the distinct advantages that we've had as having great dads.
So if you are born in a deficit and you have success in your life, and this is what I was saying to Tom, I said, Tom, you and I both had something to run from.
Right, right.
Not just something to run to. And in fact, before we had a clear vision of what to run to, we had a clear vision of what to run from. And I find that most highly successful people have both something to run from and something to run to. If you could use them in like emotional weights, you have fear and you have faith. You have what you're afraid of. I don't want to be poor like my parents, or I don't want to be unsuccessful like whoever. I don't want to have a broken home. I don't want to. And so you're running from something. I don't ever want to have to worry about where food's coming from. I don't ever want to worry about where I'm going to sleep. And so you're running from something, and it becomes a huge driver in so many entrepreneurs and in so many successful people. They're literally running from something. They're running from shadows. They're running from these haunts, the ghosts of their past. But they're also running to something. If you're only running from something, it can be incredibly destructive. And in fact, what I find is when people are only running from something but not running to something, they keep running to the thing they're running from. They end up in the same pattern, the same problems, the same crisis, the same brokenness, the same pain over and over again. They don't realize that because they're only running from something, they keep running to the same thing because that's all they know. But when you finally go, okay, I'm not just going to run from something, I'm going to run to something. I'm going to work super hard. I'm going to figure out how to develop this skill. I'm going to develop this craft. I'm going to buy a house. You know, for some of our friends, it was, I'm going to buy my mom a house. You know, my mom never had enough food. My mom never had enough, resources. She never had home. And so they're driven to make sure their mom always had a place to live, or they're driven to make sure that their family always had food on the table. And so it's not always self-indulgent. It's not always I'm running after wealth, or I'm running after things. I'm running after a car or a house or a plane or a yacht. A lot of times they're running after security for their family, a place for their mom, a place for, their brothers and sisters, and they're driven to create a different world. And you have to have something you're running from and something you're running to. And I look at my life and I look back and I go, yeah, I was definitely running from something, but it took me a little while to start running from it. And then I definitely started running to something, and those two tensions have absolutely affected my life. But I would say that there was a transition in my life where the power of what I was running from was very small. It was diminished in comparison to the power of what I was running to. And I actually think that's where emotional, psychological, and spiritual health comes from, is when you're now running to something and that overwhelms what you're running from. And I was saying the problem sometimes with growing up with privilege, with some advantages, is that you don't have as much to run from. because what do you want? You want to run from success, or you want to run from fame? Sometimes you do. In fact, I actually have seen in your life you have run from fame.
Yeah, I enjoy the podcast. I love it because everyone, all of you who are listening are where you're at.
Yeah.
And I'm where I'm at.
But I can tell you.
There's a separation and a connection. I like that. That feels safe for me.
Yeah, but I can say I've seen times in your life where I watched you elevate, elevate, elevate. And then the moment you started feeling some fame, you thought, I don't want to do that anymore.
Yes.
And I've seen that at least two or three times in your life.
Yeah.
Where you go, he's running from fame. He's trying to figure out how to have the result of fame, like influence, without the consequence of fame, which is everybody knows me.
Yeah, to some degree.
I can't hide anywhere.
Yeah, to some degree. But I think it's also like fame within what sector, right? I think... I'm going to carefully use my words, which I don't always do. But fame within the Christian church, I have no interest in, right? Fame in the world, I have no interest in. Fame, I don't have any interest in. But influence in the church, I don't have so much influence. Or have so much interest because I don't think they're worthy of, and not of me, but of destroying my life. The power that you give Christians is that the reality is that Christians cannot be trusted. Right? Like the reality of the situation. And so for me, it was, I looked at what you built and I love it and I care about it. And I live within some turmoil of going, and I really do care about the church, the greater church, and also Mosaic, our local church.
But there are a lot of Christians who listen to us and they're actually incredibly supportive.
I didn't say all were bad.
No, and you care
I just
about
said
them.
as a people group, they were undeserving of my life.
They were undeserving of your emotional well-being.
Yes, because they couldn't be trusted.
Yeah.
Right? I don't find that our community of Christians, even within we deal with this within our own church. Every church deals with it. But then the funny thing is, at the moment you like, church isn't my primary source of community. It's a part of a community that I'm a part of. So, and that's a good reminder for me, because I have friends outside who also remind me that no one cares. Right? Like, and it's really nice for me to remember that.
Yeah.
And then they take witness to moments where, you know, we're in a random place and there's someone who pops up and says, you know, I love your dad's book. Blah, 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 you jumped off the roof. And then they're like, dude, is that weird? And I'm like, yeah, no, but yes. And so like, and I think I have a healthier relationship with it now. I love the people who listen to our podcast.
Yeah.
By the way, I do love the people who go to Mosaic, but every community has its things. And so you have to, but when you're 20 years old or 16 years old or 10 years old, you don't know that, right?
But now, I mean, I go everywhere. I mean, I'm just out of the country and I have people coming up to me, emotional, tearful, going, hey, tell Aaron, the podcast has changed my life. And I just love his contribution. And I just got a text from someone who's in his 70s saying, I just listened to the podcast. And he starts talking about you as if I wasn't even on the podcast.
No, you know, what you don't know is I actually cut you out of most episodes. I'm kidding. No, that honestly means the world to me. So I am not trying to belittle the people that are a part of the community that we've built and the influence that we have gained. To be honest, the podcast was kind of my way, our way, but really my way of going, I am going to own my narrative. Because, you know, it simply started with like ex-girlfriends or girls that I had dated when I was like 18 years old that were coming out talking trash about me. And I was like, this is crazy. Like, and then I have you as my dad who says you can never respond publicly. You know, you're really that person. You're like, just the truth is the truth. The people who do that don't respond.
Yeah.
Let them go. And I'm like, no. Right? And then we were able to not so, it's not so much about controlling the narrative, but it was a part of going, I do want to be able to share the experiences that I have in life, so people also know that I'm human.
Yeah, but I also said to you, no one can ever haunt you with your closet if you open your closet and just talk about it as your life.
Yes, so I came out of the closet. In 2014, 15. No, I'm kidding. But that was a part of it, right? It was going, okay, so here's the thing, is that I felt like maybe this is the, and I'm not coming from a perspective that I'm so important, that's how I see myself. But to some degree, everybody in the world has to you have to decide, right? And so much of our language of even around the arena, the man in the arena, this idea that you step into the conversation that the world is having. And so to some degree, I had to kind of go, okay, I have to stop being a coward and just, you know, deleting my Instagram every 6 months and hiding away from the world and going, you know, I don't want everyone to hate me. And so we started doing this podcast. And so that's a part of it, right? So what I took is that I took the advantage that I had and went, you know what? My dad's a genius. He has this influence and I'm his son and I would love to ask him questions. And then we did that for years. And then it evolved during COVID. It became more of a place where I could bring things to the table and we could sit and we could dissect different human situations. And I don't know. Am I making any sense right now?
Yeah, but just going back to this, saying, the chemistry, the chemical compound is running from something and running to something.
Yes.
And so I'm just using fame as what you've been running from.
Yes.
But you have to know what you're running to. And so you have
that's
to go.
Always been a problem for me. That's always been a mountain I've had to climb, right? How did you, I don't want to make it feel small, but it always felt simple for me. It felt like your end game was always bringing people to Jesus, helping people have a relationship with faith, right? Did you ever struggle with that as being the thing that you ran to?
You know, I don't know if I was running to that as much as...
Okay, so then what were you running to?
Yeah.
What is the thing that brings you, wakes you up in the morning?
No, I think it's interesting because I think that bringing people into a relationship with Jesus was more an outcome of how much Jesus changed my life. You know what I mean? So it was like, it was just the outcome. And I did feel like this massive urgency to help people find meaning and hope and forgiveness and love through Jesus. But I think that for me, a part of what drove me was, I don't know if I've really said this as much like publicly, but I think for some reason, God has given me an ability to see things that other people can't see.
Okay.
And what drives me is to explore those things and share them with the world. And I think that's like deeply seated in my relationship with Jesus. But so I think what I've run from all my life is insignificance. I wasn't running from poverty or from, you know, homelessness or anything like that. My mom was such a hard worker. She just always made sure we had a roof over our house and overheads and food on the table and all the mangoes we could eat, you know, and I was running from insignificance, and I've been running from insignificance all my life. And early on, my fear of being insignificant was far more powerful than my vision for significance. I was just running from it, trying to do something that made my life matter. And then when I came into a relationship with Jesus, it was almost like significance was poured into my soul without having to earn it. And so I'm going, oh, I'm not having to run from insignificance now. I have significance. Now I need something to run to.
Yeah.
I wanted to change the course of human history. I didn't know how. But yeah, I never had like small ambition. You know, like I literally wanted to shape the course of human history. And this sounds so arrogant to say this, and I probably will regret saying this, but I believed that in my lifetime I should accomplish something that would be remembered thousands of years from now. And so I wasn't like, oh, I want to buy a house, or I want to have a plane, or I want to have a cruise. I wanted to leave a marker that people would remember thousands of years from now. And that's kind of like what drove me. And that's why I would study people like Da Vinci and other people who like were historical markers and go, you know, how did they discover their uniqueness that left a mark in the world? And I'm still driven to that. I'm 65 and I still have this, I guess, running from is, will I ever really leave the mark that I was created to leave? Like I'm haunted by that and I'm always running from it. And then I'm running to a vision of, I can make the world better. I can make the world better. I can help people see what's real. I can help people find meaning in life. I can help people be motivated by love. I can actually make the world better. And those two things push and pull me all the time. And I don't think they're always as clear as we wanted to make, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, we have friends like Edwin Noriave who said, hey, at first it was just having a big house and having nice cars and having the plane. He goes, that is what I was running to. And then once he had all those things, it started changing to significance, to the good he could do in the world, how much money he could give away to make people's lives difference, how many other people he could actually bring out of poverty into wealth. And so sometimes what we're running to evolves, because sometimes we don't realize that the vision's so small we catch it early.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think
it's both. Can I ask you a practical question?
Yeah, sure.
So in a practical way, how do you identify a healthy thing you're running to? And then I still want to go back and talk about the conversation with Tom and Spence, because I think so much good came out of it.
Yeah.
One, I think, you know, We're introverted, extroverted people. Like, we love people. We also really need a lot of alone time. Rarely do we find people that it's like very easy for us to just be around a lot.
It was very easy.
It was so easy. Like, it felt like they were just another version of kind of us. Of yeah. Like, they like to watch sports. They like to cook out and grill and hang and everyone. It was just a very easy, you know, it was fun. It was very fun. And we had a lot of good conversations. I think that's what inspired this conversation around this idea of needing to succeed and having to succeed versus wanting to succeed. And I don't even know where I first heard this. I feel like I heard this a few weeks back, whether it's a podcast or something. You know what? I think it was actually on a Diary of a CEO conversation with Stephen Bartlett, talking about needing to versus having to and wanting to. But did you feel that growing up, of this idea that you had to succeed? Because being forgotten would have just felt like it would have just collapsed your life.
Yeah. I my brother Alex and I have talked about, you know, this phrase which he's used, which I love. He talks about the one who must. And he said, you know, the difference is there's some people who can, and some people, you know, who, you know, should, or but there are certain people who just must. Like, they have to, or they just can't survive. And I've always been that compulsive person. I'm the one who must. Now, all my life, like, I must impact the world in some way. I must help people see who Jesus is. I must help people be free from shame and guilt and loneliness and despair. I must, like, it's not even optional for me. And I must do it. You know, I don't need to do it or have to do it or want to do it. It's like, I must do it. And that's been a bigger driver for me than being wealthy or being famous. I didn't feel like I must be famous, or I must have wealth, or I must have possessions. In fact, in some ways, sometimes I sacrificed all those things.
I mean, you talked about me running from fame, but at the height of your career in 2009, you stepped away from writing books and speaking in arenas and doing the thing that kind of made you so well known. You only spoke at Mosaic, which is the smallest stage you ever speak on, for the most part. Now it's different in business,
yeah,
you know, boardrooms and different things like that. There's obviously smaller, more intimate rooms. But growing up, you were always on tours and always speaking in arenas and always kind of flying to the next city and speaking in a very large room. And you took some time off. So, you know,
I have definitely run from fame.
Yes.
Throughout my life.
Yes.
In fact, I remember, this is funny, when Mariah was probably 8, 9, 10 years old, we're driving home, and all these, I don't know why, but all these people flooded Mosaic. I think they were probably from Korea or somewhere. And they were all asking me for photographs. And this is, oh my goodness, like, you know, 20 years ago, right? You know, And Mariah, on the way home, said, "Daddy, can I ask you a question?" I said, "Yeah." She goes, "It doesn't matter whatever the answer is, but I just need you to be honest with me." And I said, "Sure." She goes, "Are you famous?" And I said, "Well, honey, you know, I think at that time there were whatever 4 billion people on the planet." I said, "There are 4 billion people on the planet, and 3.99% of those billions don't know that I exist. So, no, I'm not famous."
No, yeah.
And she goes, "Are you sure? Because it feels like you're famous." And then I said, "Well, sweetie, I've spent my life running from fame." And then Mariah said, "I'm going to run to it."
Mariah said that? I do love her. Also, shout out Mariah. She just released a new song called, her artist name is Raya, R-I-A-H, but it's a song called Bed, and it's actually so good.
That's beautiful.
And a guy named Aiden King wrote it with her.
Oh, it's amazing.
I mean, he's...
So Bed on Spotify, Raya.
On Spotify, under Raya.
That's awesome.
She's kind of sick. Yeah.
I just thought it was so funny. It was so cute, Mariah, when she was a little girl.
Hilarious.
She was born for the stage.
And then her daughter, which Mariah, I don't feel that Mariah, she probably runs from fame more than any of us.
That's the ironic thing, is she ended up running from fame quite fast and hard.
Yeah, like every time a song did well, she just wouldn't put a song out for another year or two.
Yeah.
And it was like to the point where it's like, man, you're the most indie of indie artists.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
She's
she's the true indie artist.
Yeah, and then she writes these, she has written one of the biggest worship songs in the last 10 years with Tremble. And
right. Which we had to force on the album.
Oh my gosh. I have never stabbed people in the back to get that song.
on the album.
I still remember the night. I think it was like night for me, and it would have been late for her because she was in Nashville and I was in LA, and she sends me this demo. And I had just checked in on her, like, hey, how are you doing? I knew she was doing writing sessions, a few sessions a day. Mariah has an incredible ability to write a song in like 3 or 4 hours. And so they were doing writing sessions, which she's not a huge fan of doing with other people, because I think she's probably more introverted than both of us. And writing for her is very personable. And she goes, oh yeah, it was cool. I wrote some terrible songs. Here's one of them. And it was Tremble. And I immediately called her manager, Janelle, who's awesome and a great friend of ours, and said, did you get sent this song by Mariah too? She goes, yeah, what are we gonna do about this? And I immediately sent it to you, and you know, and she'll probably never send me a song again. And she was like, this song is terrible. And I think she had just was exhausted when she wrote it.
I called her first. She was like, this, it's not on the album. It's not gonna be on the album.
She really hated that song.
I don't usually do this, but I called Janelle and I said, Janelle, you know me, I don't impose myself. I'm very open-handed.
Yeah.
This song is going to be on the album. There's like, there's no option. It has to be on the album.
And that's where I think, that's where Mariah's greatest strength. Like she listened to us, like let us call her off of that. And Janelle was like this, because immediately from the demo, it was amazing.
Yeah.
And we were all just like, this is crazy. The song is perfect.
But back to this, again, you're running from something, running to something. You have to be careful sometimes that you're not running from the wrong thing and running to the wrong thing. And one of the things I said to Spence as I was talking about this is, look, if you are born with some privilege in your life, this is how you do it. You're not going to run from poverty because you never knew it. You're not going to run from homelessness. You're not going to run from all these different things.
Yeah.
You run from the lesser version of you.
Yeah.
And you run to the highest version of you. You run from the version of you that you're allowed to be because you have all these advantages. And you run to the version of you that it feels as if the gravitational pull of privilege is fighting against. Because when you don't have to fight for those things, you can take on characteristics like lethargy, apathy. You can actually even be depressed more. I
struggle with that.
And because depression is a luxury of the rich. A part of what develops resilience in a person's life is choosing to move to your highest self, even when you have the safety net that protects you in your lowest self.
You talked about depression being a luxury of the rich or of the wealthy, but I think everyone can get depressed, right?
Yes, what I'm saying is that
I've been poor and depressed. I've been wealthy and depressed. I've been both.
Like, I know my mom was depressed, but she still just had to get up and work every day because she had four kids that she had to take care of. And what happens a lot of times, if you're like, and this isn't you because I have never attained this level of wealth, but let's say if I had billions and then you had access to hundreds of millions, and we've known people like this,
right?
They live in a perpetual state oftentimes of depression and sadness and lethargy. And what allows them to stay in there is that they have so much wealth that it covers the deficit. And this sounds really harsh to say.
I get what you're saying. I get more of what you were saying.
See, yeah, and what I'm saying is that sometimes the only thing that gets you out of depression is when you feel needed.
Okay.
And when there's something you must do, you feel needed.
Yeah.
And it actually helps you fight depression. The days I think that I feel or most depressed are the days where I wonder if I'm making any dent in the world, if I'm doing any good in the world, am I needed? And that's when depression can pull you under. And I think it's the same way with like apathy. You only become apathetic when nothing matters to you enough to risk everything. And so I think this is why it's important to have this conversation. The only real danger of nepotism is that it causes you to lose your urgency to move forward with your life. That makes sense?
Yeah, no, of course. I think an added layer to the dynamic of having an advantage growing up, right? Because I was talking about this with one of our guys who's in town, and he asked me, like, did you grow up poor? And I was like, I grew up, you know, economically poor, but not in like spirit or happiness or family or love, right? Like I didn't have an awareness of poverty. I had to a certain degree. I mean, we were in pretty poor scenarios. You know, like the church that you took over was in one of the poorest, to this day, one of the poorest blocks
in the United States. Of, yeah,
just in California, in Los Angeles. Like there are friends of mine who have grown up in Beverly Hills and wonderful people, right? Who, when they ask, like, where'd you grow up? And I go, you know, the Soho House in downtown. And they're like, yeah, that place is sick. And like, yeah, go 15 minutes into the vastness past that, that no one from who grows up in LA goes to, you know, they're like, oh yeah, that's where warehouses are. I'm like, yeah, but people live there. And that's where we were. Like, and so there is,
I actually forget you guys actually did really grow up in the poor area. Yes,
you, it's so, cause I think, you know, I look at myself now and I like laugh because I'm like, man, we were, you know, just like, they're just even like the option to choose what clothes we wear, which is a newer, it was a thing that happened in the last 15 years, right? Like it's not, my heart goes out to people who are trying to break that cycle.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting journey because when you were a kid, I would shop at Marshall's.
Yeah.
You know, that was the economic universe that we lived in. That's reality.
Yeah.
You know? And you know, it's the ironic thing, and
I remember when going to Target was like, oh,
that was up. That was up. Step up.
That was up. That was two steps up. That was above a Walmart.
Yeah, above a Marshall's, above.
Like it was like a Kmart. That was like, you know, it was like the Kmart surplus. Yeah.
But I never felt poor. I think I was pre-rich. Because in my mind, this wasn't the state of where I was going to be all my life.
Yeah.
You know, and, but I was, I do think there was a certain point in my life where I realized I can't leave my family in this state. I have to make decisions that change our circumstance.
Yeah.
And then when we started doing that, it's funny how you're running to something really beautiful. Because when I got married, that was the first time I ever felt like, oh, I should provide. Like, I think if I were single, I was like a monastic. I lived out of a plastic bag. I had nothing. And I was fine. I was like a vagabond sometimes, you know? And when I was going to marry Kim, the pastor that I knew really well, I went to him, I said, hey, do you think I should marry this person? And he said, she's exactly the person you should marry. She was an orphan. She's never had anything. You have such a disdain for things and money and possessions that marrying her will give you a balanced view because you'll want to one day buy her house.
What a wise man. Was that Steve Johnson?
No, that was actually Bob Weatherly who told me that.
This is in Dallas.
Yeah, in North Carolina.
Or North Carolina.
Chapel Hill.
Okay, okay.
And in my mind, I'm thinking, nah, she's not going to change my mind. You know, because I was still young and naive and very, very focused on the way I saw the world. And it was true. When I got married and then we're sleeping on the floor, all of a sudden, Kim began to change my, not by saying anything, she was just so sweet, but it did change my ambition. I went, I need to be able to afford a bed. Do I really want her to live in an apartment all of her life? I need to work to buy a house. Like, it did actually change me because love affected the way, what pulled me. You know, and her poverty actually did push me. I'm just coming to this realization because I think that what I was running from was I wanted to take her away from that. I didn't want her to ever have that experience again of poverty. And then every time we became a little more successful, had a little more wealth, had a few more things, it was very uncomfortable for her. She didn't feel permission psychologically to have anything in her life. And I just, you know, and I love teasing her now going, now you're just bougie, you know, but she's not. She's the furthest thing in the world.
No, she's not, so not bougie. You know? Not at all. I wish she was a little more bougie sometimes.
Me too.
She sometimes gives me such a hard time the way I live my life. But so back to this conversation, because or just a continuation of the conversation. How do you develop the have to, the must, if you don't have to? No, because I could have stayed working at Mosaic. I could stay really comfortable and easy, and I, you know, had a good place to live, but I wanted more, and not that, and it's not that it was a better more. It was just a different more, right? It was just a different. It was like, I wanted something different. I wanted to build another path. And okay, so how do you create this must inside of your mind or your body, right? Because I told the young guy that we were with in Mexico, I was like, man, let me tell you this, first off, like it's not, people, because we talked about like the image of like, sometimes it's in our own heads that people perceive us a certain way. And I was like, yeah, you can't, and it's hard because I think that becomes the hard thing. When you have nothing, you're at the bottom already. And I'm not meaning in a bad way, like you're valuable, but economically, if you're at zero, you're at zero, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like anything up is just up, it's good. It's but when you start at what, I don't know, I'm, you know, just picking a billion, right? You know, the brothers that we used to hang with that really did struggle, and each brother had a different thing. One brother took the money, hid one. It's almost like the conversation of the parable of the talents. It was like one brother did nothing, squandered everything. One brother invested and grew it. One brother stayed stable and it grew it a little bit. You know, so there's these different layers. But when you start at kind of, you know, the top or the middle, it's harder because there's room to, you're looking down going, I can fall and I'm going to die if I end up there, you know? And you look up and you go, I don't know how I got here. So how am I going to get there? Right? So there is this like, this mind, you know, mess up, this thing that gets into your mind, and it's kind of a virus, you know? So how do you develop the must?
I immediately saw four pillars.
Okay.
The first pillar is you will only achieve what you believe you're worthy of. And so you have to change your sense of identity as self-esteem. You have to believe that you're created to do something special, something important, something meaningful with your life. And I've had to deal a lot with, I've had to do a lot of work internally on this area because whenever I achieve any level of success, I don't feel like I deserve it. I don't feel like I'm worthy of it. And it's always a battle for me. And now that I'm at this age of my life, I know it probably will always be a battle for me. But since I realize it's always a battle, I might as well achieve more and battle with it at the higher. The second pillar is how hard you're willing to work. And I know I'm kind of going against a lot of the new cultural things of, hey, don't work hard, you know, those people who have hustle and drive and ambition.
This podcast isn't for those people.
Yeah, I'm not that person. Like the second pillar to me is, you know, how badly do I want something? How hard am I willing to work? How much discipline am I willing to put into something to be great at it? You know, and the third pillar to me is, how humble can I be to keep learning? Like that must for me is connected to my willingness to learn. Learning is painful because you have to acknowledge you don't know. There has to be a humility of your incompetency in a sense, or your inability, and you have to keep learning and learning and learning. And then that fourth pillar, you have to change how you see yourself. You have to change the work you're willing to put in. You have to change the learning that you're willing to do. And then I'm going to forget my fourth one. Oh, yeah. You have to change the people that you associate with. And all four of those have changed my life, and they elevate my must. Because every time I'm around people with greater ambition for life, it changes my must. I elevate. I realize, oh, I thought I was intense. Oh, I thought I was hungry. Oh, I thought I was driven, but I was wrong. This is what it can look like. And then when I'm around people who are high capacity, I realize, oh, I have so much more to learn. I have so much more to learn. I have so much more to learn. And I feel like now at this stage of my life, I'm in my highest learning mode. I have to learn so much because I'm trying to do so much. I'm trying to accomplish things I've never accomplished. So I'm a pool of ignorance, trying to rapidly fill myself with knowledge in this new area. And then, you know, then you have to go, am I willing to put the work in? Like, am I willing to take on the disciplines to develop this? And let me tell you, one thing that happens as you get older is that everyone around you is landing their plane and slowing down and settling in, and you have to decide, Is there something I want so much that it gets me up in the morning? And fortunately I do. And you're a huge part of that. You are a huge part of the gravitational pull. I love creating with you. And I'm like, man, if I can keep a sharp mind and a healthy body, and we can create for the next 30 years, I would consider that to be one of the greatest gifts of my, you know, to my life, not just from my life. And then also the identity part, it's hard for me because I've been a pastor so long too. And there's always that weight of, you know, if you're a pastor, you should have no human ambitions in life. And to go, I actually want to break the code. I want to be able to go, oh, this is, we are able to break the code to 10 million and break the code to 50 million, break the code to 100 million. I know it sounds crazy, but for me, it's like this really exciting puzzle.
Yeah.
And because I go, I'll never make enough money that Kim can't give away.
That girl is a black hole.
She's a black hole of generosity. And so I go, I want the people, I am a ceiling. The people in my life that work with me, work for me, are dependent on my clarity. Their salaries are limited by my own ceiling. If I can actually create more, they're actually gonna have more. And I want everyone whose life I touch in LA to be able to own a home. And you want that. You've already expressed that to me.
Yeah.
And so I'm going, I have to elevate my ceiling, or I actually become such a low ceiling to all the people who are faithfully giving their lives and their talents to help us succeed. And so my whole framework is affected by these four pillars. And that to me is what ignites my must.
Mm, I love it. We've been going for like 50 minutes.
I think we should
wrap it up.
Land the plane.
Okay. Hey man, I just want to say thank you. Thank you so much for having this conversation. As we wrap this up, I think, you know, my brain is firing off. I have so many thoughts and ideas and things I want to talk about because I want to come from the approach that, you know, the advantage that I've had in life is proximity. Is that, you know, when people ask, like, you know, how'd you do it? Or not how'd you do it. I think people look at me and go, well, he stayed close to daddy. So that's why he's succeeding. And I look at it and go, you're just mad that I picked the right horse. That you're just mad that I, you know, and I'm like, I was always okay with being on a team. That part of it too, right? Like I was okay being Steve Kerr with Michael Jordan. And look at Steve Kerr's life now. You know, one could say he went from being a great shooting guard to now one of the greatest coaches of all time. You know, and so I look at it and I go, advantages is we all have an advantage, and I think even growing up with nothing is an advantage to some degree, right? Because it having that hunger, something you cannot replicate, something that you cannot fake later in life. You know, and so I was talking with my new friend. I was like, you have to find something that drives you. There has to be a goal, right? And there has to be some type of depth to that goal. It can't just be monetary, or it will displace the time and the moment in which you feel empty.
Yeah.
Right? Because you'll just feel empty later when you make your billion or make your half a billion and you decide to just ride off into the sunset on an island. You know, then you'll get there and feel the emptiness. And so this conversation I think is so important because one, the idea of running to something is essential to having purpose in life. You're saying identify that purpose and drive towards it and be relentless in your efforts to achieve that goal. And that's something I got to work on, right? Because I can feel lost. I have these moments where I'm like, even in our greatest successes and our biggest moments, I go, I feel lost. I feel, you know, what am I driving to? What are we going towards? And we have this conversation all the time, sometimes maybe too much. It's like memento, we have amnesia, we write it on our bodies like you did good. But no, I just want to say thanks. Well, thank you for the advantage. Thank you for both the hunger that I think you help just through attrition. You have this insatiable hunger to just do and bring good things into life. So thank you for that. And secondly, thanks for bringing me and a couple of the guys with us on the journey. I appreciate you. So okay. Thank you.
I love you, bud.
I'm glad we're back on this podcast, and I'm so too. Happy you're feeling better.
Mindshift community, we love you. We're so glad to be back
guys.
With you.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm so grateful. All right, we'll see you guys next week.